Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with musician David Jeunesse about songwriter Harold Arlen. And we will be speaking to Barbara Harrelson about literary destinations in Santa Fe. I'm very happy now to welcome Cy Khan. He is a community organizer, he's a musician, and he's the author of the new book, Creative Community Organizing, a strategy manual for rabble-rousers, activists, and quiet lovers of justice. And he will be here in Santa Fe this weekend on Saturday, January 30th at 7 o'clock at the United Church of Santa Fe on Arroyo Chamiso. And he will also be the night before in Montezuma at the United World College. That's Friday, the 29th of January at 7 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
I am very happy to be here.
You are a community organizer. The book is called Creative Community Organizing. The label community organizer got a lot of fame and notoriety, shall we say, during the last presidential election campaign. What does a community organizer really do, and how did you get inspired to go into that line of work?
Oh, great question. Well, first, you know, it was just so wonderful. For the first time in my life, people were actually saying, now, what's a community organizer again? Right? So we sort of had this anonymous profession, and all of a sudden, people are talking about it. Here's what we do. Community organizers help people learn the skills of democracy, which are the skills of working together, so that you take the power of numbers and you set it against the power of money, of corporations, and use that organized power to get the things that make people's lives better. You know, healthcare, housing, justice on the job, an end to sexual harassment, you know, native rights for native peoples. So many of the things that actually we take for granted today came about not because somebody with great power said, time to do something, because people with relatively little power got themselves together and made their demands in skillful ways so that people had to listen and make a change. I mean, if we just take, for example, the Americans with Disability Act, that didn't come about because people in Congress said, gee, we really should do something about people who are differently abled than others. It's because people who were differently abled than others said, we're tired of being excluded from society by all these barriers that we can't surmount and shouldn't be expected to surmount. And they lobbied, they demonstrated, they wrote letters, they built or powerful organizations, they built coalitions, they got allies. And today, we take for granted that everything should be accessible. So that's I think, one of dozens and hundreds of examples of the power of community organizing.
You came into it because you were inspired by what was happening during the civil rights movement. And last
Absolutely.
Week we talked about Martin Luther King at great length. What was your own experience? I mean, you were a very young person when you really got charged up.
I started working as a community organizer with SNCC. SNCC was short for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was the student wing of the Southern Civil Rights Movement. That was my first organizing job. I made $15 a week, in fact, which is not bad for those days. We also had free board, and the people in the community fed us and helped us along. But I was passionate about social justice from a much younger age. I was raised, my dad's a rabbi, my mother was an artist, and they raised me with an Old Testament sense of right and wrong, of justice and injustice, of good and evil. They weren't exactly religious fundamentalists, as we think of the word. They were very politically progressive people, although they didn't think of themselves as political people. They simply thought of themselves as people who should do the right thing. And that's exactly how I was raised. I was raised with the absolute firm expectation that if somebody was being pushed around, that I would say something. I was raised with the absolute belief that you can make a change if you care about it. And, I mean, to this day, when I'm in one of those moments where I think, should I say something or not, you know, because there's something racist or anti-Semitic has been said, because somebody's been treated not quite right, and I'm tired, and I really don't want to do it. And I think, you got to do it. Otherwise, your folks will be disappointed in you. And I think that this is in common with, you know, millions of people. You don't have to be political. You don't have to be an activist. You don't have to be an organizer to think that we should do right by people, to think that we're here on Earth not just, you know, to make money for ourselves or not just to make ourselves happy. Those things are reasonable. I think people should make a living. I think people should be happy. But we have an obligation. Just because we're here on this Earth, I absolutely believe that we have an obligation to help other people. And I think part of what makes me a good organizer is I think everybody's got it inside them. I don't think you need to be raised in a certain way. I don't think you need to come from a certain part of the country. I think you can come from any kind of identity or religious background or lack of religious background. I think you could have two PhDs or have never have gone to school, like my grandparents, and you can still make a tremendous difference and leave something behind so that people will actually remember you for good.
Still, I mean, that said, not everybody is going to get into their car and go to Arkansas or Alabama during the 1960s and put themselves, if not in harm's way, into a lot of very awkward positions, which you write about in an extremely humorous and honest way in your book, Creative Community Organizing.
Some of those things weren't so funny at the time.
Right.
Right. I mean, hindsight's wonderful. Here's what I did. First, I got involved in civil rights during what was called the Selma to Montgomery March. Now, this is history now, and most people, when you say that, they say, I hadn't been born yet. It was another 20 years before I was born. So here's what happened. In the Southern Civil Rights Movement started in 1961. This is one of the famous incidents when four African-American students from Greensboro A&T, now called, then college, now university, sat down at a lunch counter in a Woolworths, and when they were told to move, refused. Now, today you say, why were they asked to move? Well, in those days, lunch counters in the South, by the way, started the Mason-Dixon line. This was true in Maryland, and it was true in the District of Columbia. They were segregated. That African-Americans were not allowed to eat sitting down in restaurants that served the white public. And these four young students one night said, that's wrong. They were influenced by people who had worked with Gandhi and knew a little bit about nonviolent civil disobedience. And they just sat down, and when they refused to move, angry crowds of young whites came, dragged them off, threw Cokes at them, poured coffee on them. The police came and arrested them. And within a week, there were sit-ins all over the United States, everywhere. So that started the Southern Civil Rights Movement. And of course, the establishment resisted. In 1964, 3 years after Greensboro, because the government of Alabama was being so intransigent in resisting the civil rights movement, the leadership of the movement decided to march from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama. And hundreds of people lined the highways and marched, intending to march for days and days. When they started to leave Selma, there's a river to the east, and it's spanned by a bridge called the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And as they began to cross that bridge, 100 Alabama state troopers mounted on horses with billy clubs, rode them down, clubbed them on the ground, sent 79 of them to the hospital. The quite wonderful member of Congress, John Lewis, was given a concussion so bad that his life hung in the balance. Now, these are law enforcement personnel beating people from their mount on a horse with lead-weighted billy clubs, beating them hard enough to send that many of them to the hospital. Standing by, taking notes, were dozens and dozens of U.S. federal marshals, armed representatives of the federal government, who did nothing to stop the violence. So all over the country, the civil rights movement set up picket lines at federal installations, the federal buildings that we have in most of our cities, saying to the federal government, do your job. Support the safety and security of everybody in this country. And I ended up, for the first time in my life, on a picket line helping make that demand. And I loved it. And some of the people I met said, you know, you should think about going south. And by the way, they wanted me to go south, not because I knew anything at all about organizing, not because I was particularly political or historical. I wasn't any of those things. But I was a very good carpenter and auto mechanic. And in a movement, somebody needs to keep the cars and trucks running, and somebody needs to build the library shelves in the tables in the Freedom Centers, and that was me.
So you were 21 years old and a good auto mechanic and carpenter, but quite green in many ways, and you went to Arkansas, and you got involved in all the things that were happening there, and you proved yourself to be quite green in a lot of ways, but the people who you worked with were not only patient with you, but as you say, they were strategic, because they could see in you the energy of a future community organizer, and they were going to teach you how to do it.
Well, I guess they were teaching everybody who came through. I don't know that they saw anything special in me, but I think that like so many people who are committed to whatever work they do, they saw as part of their responsibility raising up a new generation of organizers. Now, this is not generation by age, because some of the people in the project were in their 70s and were brand new at organizing. But part of what we do as community organizers, we pass this on. It's a craft. It's a trade. I served an apprenticeship working with people who were much wiser and more experienced than I am. And I try very, very much to pass those same kinds of things on to people today who say, you know, this stuff you do, it's interesting. I wonder if I should do it. Can I give you an example from New Mexico?
Please do.
Well, I work for Grassroots Leadership. We do civil rights, labor, and community organizing actually on a national basis, although we've got offices primarily in the South, here in Charlotte, North Carolina, where I live, in Houston and Austin in Texas, and in Montezuma, New Mexico, just out from Las Vegas. So our commitment is primarily to work to abolish for-profit private prisons, jails, and detention centers, including immigrant detention centers. And you probably know, New Mexico has the highest percentage of its state prisoners in for-profit private prisons of any of the 50 states. 47% of New Mexico state prisoners are in for-profit facilities. It's actually, I guess it's this world's record, but not one that any state would want to hold. So Grassroots Leadership co-hosted a youth conference for Dr. King's birthday. We had 450 people come from Taos, from Santa Fe, from Las Vegas, just helping them learn about issues, helping learn the skills of social justice work. Now, probably a tiny handful of those people will decide to do some kind of social justice work, some kind of creative community organizing as their life's work, or even as their work for part of their life. But what we hope is that all of them will realize that whatever else they choose to do to make a living, that they will spend part of their time and energy and heart trying to make a difference and make the world better for everybody. My life is an example of the handful of people who do this professionally, and we're just there to help everybody else learn how to do it. It's community organizers. We ourselves are only there as catalysts. We can't do anything by ourselves. It's when hundreds and thousands and hundreds of thousands of people do a little bit that the world really changes.
We're talking to community organizer and musician Cy Khan. Now, doing this work, you have to learn courage and to deal with confrontation and sometimes even violent people. What were some of the greatest lessons that you learned?
Well, I don't think I ever learned courage. What you learn is to overcome fear. I think it's a different thing. I've known people who were truly courageous. I'm not. I close my eyes and wince when it looks like it's going to get sticky. But what I've learned is that, first, that nonviolence really is important. That you can't resort to violence to fight violence. First, on a practical level, it just doesn't work. But secondly, we're really trying to build a peaceful society, a nonviolent society, something that works for everybody. And one of the things I've really decided over the years, I didn't decide in the sense that I thought of it, but I really came to agree with the people who say, you can't build a peaceful, nonviolent society by violent means. I think this is the great lesson of Mahatma Gandhi and of Dr. Martin Luther King, whose birthday we again celebrated. Wonderful to have a, a holiday celebrating him. And I know Dr. King would say, as he said many, many times, this is not about me. This is about everyone who fights for the civil rights of all people. And I've learned, too, that if you don't respond in kind, meaning if you don't respond violently or angrily to violence or anger, that often it diffuses the situation. There's a story I tell in the book about a wonderful SNCC organizer whose name is Vincent O'Connor. I worked in Arkansas for SNCC in Forest City, Arkansas, which was named after General Nathan Bedford Forrest, a Confederate cavalry leader who was one of the founders of the Ku Klux Klan. How's that for somebody to name your town after? And we were on a picket line one day, and Vince, who was working on a project in a different county, had come over with some other folks from that county to support the picket line, to support the freedom movement. He was just quietly watching. Oh, and Vince was a member of the Catholic Worker Movement. This was founded some time ago by Dorothy Day, a great peace activist. So Vince was walking in the picket line, and this truck came hurtling towards the line, you know, tires screeching, and a furious red-faced, huge white guy came out and pulled a .45 automatic out of his belt, walked up to Vince, who was probably the only white person on the picket line, stuck it in his stomach. I wasn't there, so I don't know what he actually said, but it was obviously really raw and violent. And he waited for Vince to, you know, hit him or swing or whatever, and Vince just stood there and didn't say anything. And, you know, the guy yelled, "Didn't you hear what I said? Didn't you hear what I said?" And Vince said, "I did. I'm just so sorry you feel that way." And the people who came back to the Freedom Center afterwards said, you know, it was like time stood still. And then finally the guy said, "Ah, you're not worth killing," and just spun around and got into his truck and screeched off. Now, I don't have that kind of courage. I have schooled myself in difficult situations not to respond with anger because, it, you know, you can't predict what would happen. But I believe that if Finn said, responded angrily, that the guy might have shot him. It's a tough lesson to learn, but I think it's really important for all of us who are involved in community organizing and social justice work.
Last week, as I mentioned, we spent several days on the life of Martin Luther King and his sermons, and one of the points that was brought out was how the disintegration of communities makes organizing people more difficult because they don't know each other. People don't know the person who lives in the apartment across the hall. People don't know the person down the street. Has that affected, that change in society affected your work?
You know, it has and it hasn't. I think it's a little bit more complicated than that because when people all live together and they see each other every day, there's some great strengths that make organizing easier. But on the other hand, it's also easier for established patterns to become self-reinforcing. So sometimes when people don't know each other as well, don't have that much experience with them, you have a slightly fresher slate to start with. So I think in some situations, yes, it makes organizing harder, and I think in some situations it makes it easier. There are so many different factors that go into the question of whether you can successfully organize in a particular place, at a particular time, with a particular group of people around a particular issue. You have to take all of these into account. But I would say, generally speaking, that some of that decline in community is offset, for example, by the amazing democratization of the media. When I was with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the Southern Civil Rights Movement, there wasn't a radio station anywhere that we could announce something on. The majority of the stations were white, and the black stations were under such economic and political pressure that they didn't dare say something. There were some heroic exceptions, and some of the northern African-American stations with strong signals were really important in the Southern Civil Rights Movement. But now, you and I can talk about this on the air, and people all over New Mexico are going to hear it. It's an amazing thing. That makes things easier. Facebook, you know, the Internet, Twitter, all of these things, you know, there are these amazing stories about Iran, about countries around the world, where within an hour, because of Twitter, people gathered by the hundreds of thousands. That was not something we could do in 1965. We had mimeograph machines, which are hand-cranked duplicates, almost impossible kind of miniature printing presses that had very little speed and were difficult to operate. So I think that for every age, you know, every social change makes some things easier and some things harder. I don't think that it's harder to organize today than it was in 1965. And I think we've seen some extraordinary examples of organizing in recent years that do, in what they challenge, what they try to take on, I think they rival a lot of what happened in the Southern Civil Rights Movement. I do not mean any disrespect to the Southern Civil Rights Movement, to the National Civil Rights Movement in saying that, but this country has had many, many wonderful transformative movements, and there sure are a lot of great organizers and activists and community members out there today who are determined to make this country live up to its promise, to the promises it made to its own people.
What do you think are some of the most effective and most successful results of community organizing in recent years?
Oh, well, we could look at the women's movement. If you look at the position of women, let's say just 50 years ago, in 1960, it's a radical, radical change. You know, at every level of society, the civil rights movement is obviously one of those examples. The environmental movement is a terrific example of that, that we have regulations and ways of being that nobody could imagine. You know, today, if you throw a bottle into the grass, some five-year-old kid is going to yell at you. I mean, this is a radical change in people's thinking. The LGBTQ movement, the fact that we're arguing over whether lesbians and gays and bisexuals and transgender people can marry, 50 years ago, everybody was hidden within their communities. It was publicly unacceptable to say anything. So, and are any of these things perfect? No. Is there a long way to go? Of course there is. But I think these are all examples of very successful community organizing efforts. You know, legislation has responded, culture has responded, economics have responded, but nobody ever gives anybody anything. Rights are not given. Rights are taken.
Tell us more about your group, Grassroots Leadership. You have taken on a very difficult issue, the whole issue of private prisons. How's it going?
You know, it's going remarkably well. Now, it's going remarkably well with the understanding that there's still some 120,000 people in for-profit private prisons. And as I pointed out, a tremendous number of them in New Mexico. Well, let me give you a real example. So, for example, most people haven't heard of these things because it's kept very much below the radar. But in the town of Taylor, Texas, there was a incarceration facility called the T. Don Hutto Family Residential Facility. Doesn't that sound nice? But what it actually was a prison for young children and their parents. Right? This is here in the United States of America. And in what we just call it Hutto for short, immigrant children, as young as babies in arms, 4-year-olds, 8-year-olds, 15-year-olds, were in cells. For a long time, they were behind razor wire with armed guards. Eventually, the ACLU sued and got the razor wire taken down and got the kids out of the orange jumpsuits. Can you imagine a 5-year-old wearing an orange jumpsuit and with like maybe an hour of recreation, an hour of education a day? And what had their parents done? Like 12 million other people, they had been asked to come here by some company that offered them employment but didn't offer them the documentation that allows you to stay in this country. And so you had 150 of these kids. And the issue was called immigrant family detention, so Grassroots Leadership, working with many allies, launched a campaign to end immigrant family detention. We never do anything alone. We worked with local organizations, we worked with national organizations, many, many good people, many good organizations. We're excellent coalition builders. We're a fairly small organization, but we have that kind of leverage. And we started a national campaign to end this practice. Meanwhile, it got worse because ICE, you know, the immigration enforcement arm of the Department of Homeland Security, set out a request for proposals to build 3 new immigrant family detention centers. They saw this as a deterrent. They thought, well, if we lock people's kids up with them, maybe they'll stop crossing the border. People don't stop crossing the border because they're coming here to work and because there are no jobs where they are and because American companies and corporations and families ask them to come here to work. So when we started the campaign, I will tell you, I wasn't at all sure we could even make a dent in it. But last August 9th, right after we had spent 2 days planning the next 2 years of the campaign and saying to each other, well, we don't actually know whether this one is a winner or not. And 2 days later, the federal government announced they were taking every single kid, every single parent out of Hutto, that they would not build these three new immigrant family detention centers. And now they're reevaluating whether, in fact, they should be using this level of detention for people who are just here without documents. You know, that's not even, that's a parking ticket level violation. It's a civil violation. It's not something you put people in detention centers and jails for. So here's grassroots leadership with 10 staff people, but working with many other great organizations, as we do in New Mexico and Texas, North Carolina and West Virginia. We were able to leverage that kind of power. We, you know, we used Facebook. We had people around the country send Valentines to the kids. We had them send presents for different holidays. We held vigils. We did media. We went after the corporation. All the things that you do in a creative community organizing campaign, and we won. Now, are there still some families in detention? Yes. Are there 37,000 individuals in immigrant detention? Yes. Are there still private prisons? Yes. But remember, Mary Charlotte, I talked earlier about you got to have hope and you got to keep the faith. And we've been able to maintain enough pressure on the private prison corporations that I maintain real hope that someday this absolutely absurd method of punishment will be abolished in this country.
Whenever the subject of private prisons come up, I always have to think of the question, why doesn't the mafia just buy all the private prisons, and then when their people go to jail, they can do whatever they want?
Mary Charlotte, you are a genius. That is a brilliant suggestion. Wow! You should talk to them about this.
Yeah.
Great idea.
Well, it's just about time to go, but I just wanted to let people know again, we're talking to Cy Khan. He is the author of the new book, Creative Community Organizing, a strategy manual for rabble-rousers, activists, and quiet lovers of justice. He is a musician, and he will be in Santa Fe both speaking and singing. Is that right?
Well, no, that Santa Fe, I think, is only a concert. Now, I'll tell some stories, but that's basically a concert. When I'm up in Montezuma at United World College, that's right next to Las Vegas, that'll be a talk with songs. So Nothing happens without songs in my life.
Excellent. Well, the talk in Montezuma at the United World College is Friday, January 29th at 7 in the evening. And then the following night, Saturday, January 30th, Cy will be here at United Church of Santa Fe on Arroyo Chamiso. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Hey, Mary Charlotte, it was great. The coffee was fabulous. The ambience was terrific. And thanks so much for your work.
Well, thank you for your work, and we look forward to seeing you. And we're going to go out now with a song by Cy Khan.
The man called Tito and Hutto must have been some kind of man, 'cause he sure got a man-sized share of fame. It's not just anybody gets their name put on a building where children are held prisoner in their name. The town of Taylor, Texas, is just an hour from Austin, but when you're there, you're in a world away. Look inside the prison yard, just beyond the chain link fence, you will see young children at their play. You might well stop and ask yourself, what have these young children done to be sentenced to such painful loss and fear? It's all because their mom or dad was caught here without documents, like 12 million others living here. Now you may think all immigrants should go back where they came from, and if they don't, hell, let them rot in jail. But if it was your own daughter in a cell at T. Don Hutto, holding your grandchild in her arms, how would you feel? What would you say if your own 2, 4, 6, or 8-year-old was growing up in prison like these kids? Since when in these United States do we put kids in prison because of what we say their parents did? Call it family detention. Say we do it for the children. You're lying to yourself down to the roots. But call it playing politics with children's lives and sanity. You're getting somewhat closer to the truth. So if you're down in Austin, take the highway out to Taylor. Bring some good friends with you for the ride. You might even wear a flag pin to show you still believe in the dream for which so many fought and died. Step out onto the highway, turn to face the prison, stare at those walls till you forget your name. Say a prayer for T. Don Hutto. Say a prayer for all those children. And close your eyes and hang your head in shame.
I'm very happy now to welcome David Jeunesse. He is a vocalist. He's author of the book Classic American Popular Song, The Second Half Century. And he will be playing a celebration of the enduring American popular song this coming Sunday, January 31st, from 4 to 6 at Vanessi of Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
It's great to have you back. We talked last year about your book, and I guess this is the 5th year of this type of a concert. You do it every year, and it started with the publication of the book.
It started back in 2005, and this will be the 5th year, and it's always a benefit, and the benefit this year is for Recursos de Santa Fe.
So you are singing and playing. We'll talk about the musicians in a moment, too. The songs of Harold Arlen.
This is a 2-hour program. I'm doing all Harold Arlen songs. There's another vocalist who's wonderful. Her name is Patty Stevens. She's from Albuquerque. And she will be doing American standards and also some Brazilian music. She and Bert Dalton have a Brazil project that
nice.
Is really wonderful. So that'll be a nice mix. But I'm sticking with Harold Arlen this time.
Now tell us about Harold Arlen. He made famous some songs that everybody knows, probably the most famous of which is Over the Rainbow.
Well, he's a very interesting songwriter. He's one of the greatest songwriters of our tradition. And he was born in 1905 and he died in the mid-70s. And he's of the generation just, not the first generation of Kern and Berlin and Gershwin, but the second generation of Cole Porter and Richard Rodgers, so they're contemporaries. And a very interesting thing about Arlen is he's written many of the most famous songs in the entire tradition, but he's a little less known as a person than the others. And I think the reason for that is, although he wrote some Broadway shows, most of his most famous songs, and there are a lot of them, were for films. And somehow you get less fame, less press, less cultural attention if you write for the movies than if you write for Broadway.
Because people, when they think of Over the Rainbow, they think of Judy Garland more than they think of Harold Arlen.
That's right. You don't say it's a Harold Arlen movie the way you might say it's a Harold Arlen show.
Right.
But the titles are really impressive. I'll just... I don't know what your age distribution is, but I'll just read some of the most famous.
I know we've got listeners starting at about 6 years old who sometimes come in on the way to school and say hello.
Well, some of these titles will be familiar to almost anybody. Over the Rainbow, Stormy Weather, Let's Fall in Love, Get Happy, Accentuate the Positive, Blues in the Night, The Man That Got Away, I've Got the World on a String, It's Only a Paper Moon, That Old Black Magic. This rings a lot of bells with people who are 50 and older. And those are movie songs, mostly.
And it's funny how some of them sort of weather better than others. Like, Accentuate the Positive is really a period piece.
It really is.
Whereas some of these other songs, Stormy Weather, they just keep remaking it.
Yeah, yeah. Arlen was the favorite songwriter for some really heavy hitters. He's the favorite songwriter of Judy Garland, Lena Horne, and Tony Bennett. Tony Bennett still sings an awful lot of Harold Arlen. He really loves that material.
So what is your own history with this music? I mean, you wrote this book. Did you get into this whole songwriting tradition as a vocalist yourself?
Well, yes and no. When I was very, very young, I had a job in the Hollywood movie studios as a musician, and I got to know Arlen, as a matter of fact, at that time. So I've been sort of collecting his songs for many, many years, and one of the reasons I wrote the book is I had all these songs, and I really wanted to bring them before the public. But I'm not a professional singer. I mean, I've done it on and off all my life, but it's not something I make a living at.
What were you playing an instrument when you played for the studios?
I was playing piano, but I was also a vocal coach and kind of a rehearsal pianist at that time. And that's, as I say, 50 years ago. It wasn't my career.
And so that wasn't your career, but now you have kept this tradition up. And I have to say, I find myself wondering, with music like this, a lot of which I love and has a very sentimental place, even though it's not really the music of my generation.
Right.
Are younger people listening to it or making it their own in some way? Are some of these songs still alive, so to speak?
Well, it's hard to answer that quantitatively. One thing is that Harold Arlen is very much beloved by jazz musicians. I mean, I would say those jazz musicians who have trios and quartets after about 1950 did a lot of Arlen. Before 1950, they'd be playing probably Gershwin. But Arlen is very, very popular among jazz musicians, so that keeps it alive. And an interesting thing about his style is that he combines two streams in American popular music that are very interesting. One is he was born in Buffalo, and he was the son of a cantor. And he writes very Jewish music in the sense of his melodic lines often use a Jewish scale and a kind of melismatic, very chromatic line. Not that you sit there and think that's Jewish, but in fact that's where it comes from.
Very
but the other part of his persona was that he was deeply into black music, and he began his career in about 1930 writing songs for the Cotton Club up in Harlem, which was all the greats. That was the Uptown Music Center in the 30s. And so he often does, many of his songs are kind of pop blues or lyrical blues, and that's why he's appealing to jazz musicians.
It is interesting sometimes how music that we associate as very much in the African American tradition is written by some nice Jewish white guy.
Yeah, some of the best.
Yeah, a lot of the a lot of Harry Belafonte's most famous songs.
Well, of course, he didn't write those songs,
yeah,
but,
exactly.
But they have that mixture of black Creole, jazz. It's a very important style. And of course, Gershwin wrote Porgy and Bess, which combines the same stuff: Jewish composer writing a black kind of idiom.
Right. So you are playing with Bert Dalton on keyboards. He's a wonderful musician in Santa Fe, and bassist Luis Guerra.
Luis is a fantastic bass player. I wish he were living in Santa Fe, but he comes up from Albuquerque a lot. And Patti Stevens is wonderful, too.
And so all of you are always playing and singing together, or you're doing some numbers and Patti doing some others?
We spell each other off. I'll do two short sets. I'll do two sets, and she'll do two sets, and we'll mix and match.
So we're going to hear a song. Tell us about what we're about to hear.
Well, I thought I would call to your attention one of those Cotton Club numbers, because it's old-fashioned, but it's a lot of fun. It's It's called Raising the Rent, and it's from 1930 or 1931, and it has to do with what it was like living in Harlem in the early 30s and having no money, and it's about a mean old landlord, and they used to have rent parties. You know, all the folks would get together and bring food and bring cheap wine and bring a little money, and if you couldn't pay your rent, you'd have a rent party. So that's what this song is about. It's a lot of fun.
Very nice. David Jeunesse is a vocalist. Once again, the celebration of the enduring American popular song is this Sunday, January 31st, from 4 to 6 in the afternoon at Vanessi of Santa Fe. You can find them at VanessiSantaFe.com, or you can also call 505-982-9966. David Jeunesse, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Crossed me, bad luck has tossed me down to my one last cent. I'm right in the middle, solving that riddle known as raising the rent. Steal, beg, or borrow, got till tomorrow, landlord's a mean old gent. It's come to a showdown, he wants the lowdown if I'm raising the rent. The better times are taking too long, panic's on, and it's hitting me too strong. Got a right to sing a blues song, trouble has got me down. I've made my mind up, I'd rather wind up camping out in a tent than being in the middle, solving that riddle known as raising the rent. Times are taking too long, panic's on, and it's hitting too strong. Got a right to sing a blues song, trouble has got me down. I've made my mind, I'd rather wind up camping out in a tent than being in the middle of solving that riddle known as raising the rent, known as raising the rent.
I'm very happy now to welcome Barbara Harrelson. She is the author of the book Walks in Literary Santa Fe, A Guide to Landmarks, Legend, and Lore. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mayor Charlotte. I'm happy to be here today.
So there's a number of events coming up around your book, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. But literary Santa Fe, it's a funny thing. Literature, when you look at buildings, is invisible unless somebody tells you that a famous person lived there or was inspired or whatever. How did you get the idea to write this book?
Well, I've been interested in literature, and I got interested in becoming a tour guide when I moved to Santa Fe. And I found that nobody was doing much, there wasn't much going on with literature at that time. And I had actually collected a series of little literary walking tour guides from various cities around the world, like London, Paris, New York City has several. And I just thought, Santa Fe needs a literary tour guide.
And so when a person has your book in their hand, what can they do? What, give us some examples of what they can see.
Well, I mean, it gives them background information. It also gives them specific information on sites like the cathedral, like the plaza, and La Fonda, and the Fray Angelico Chavez Library, and Witterbinner House, and any number of places. But as you pointed out before, a lot of landmarks are not thought of as literary landmarks until you point out all of the connections with authors, stories, and famous characters, like Death Comes for the Archbishop is the obvious one that goes with the cathedral basilica.
And for those who have read it, then coming to this, I think probably many people have read Death Comes for the Archbishop, then they come to Santa Fe, and these places are alive for them in a whole different way.
Yes. And another very popular spot on the walking tour, because of, I don't know, it just seems that there's more interest in this subject of late, is 109 East Palace, where that was the secret check-in office for the Manhattan Project. And, of course, there's a book by that title, 109 East Palace, which has been out for about 4 or 5 years now.
I do sometimes wonder, you know, so you go to 109 East Palace, and there's something there. What is there now?
It's actually, I think it is still a fine linen shop called Onorato.
And so you go to this place, you think about what it was, what it means.
Mm-hmm.
But doing a literary walking tour really requires a certain amount of imagination on the part of the walker.
It does. And I get, I guess I would have to say, kind of a select group of book lovers and culture travelers who sign up for my tour. And I get a lot of questions back and forth. And so what we do is, yes, we stop on the street opposite 109 East Palace, and I start telling them things about the book and about the history, and then they chime in, and it does. It comes alive for them.
So you're going to be giving some actual tours?
Yes, I have been doing tours since 1996. And in 1998, my tours got listed in the Frommer's Guide to Santa Fe, Albuquerque, and Taos. And I get a lot of my referrals from people who read about it and decide they want to do something a little bit different in Santa Fe.
And you're also going to be doing some other events.
Well, I'm really, I mean, my book has been out for a couple of years now. But periodically, I look for opportunities to bring the literary scene in Santa Fe to the attention of the residents, even, because when I first started giving the literary walking tour, I had people ask me, a literary walking tour? Well, what do you do? And what is there to say? And as soon as I would start pointing out some of our beloved classics and how I could tie it to various landmarks, they would say, ah, yes, I get it. But and so I just think that literature, the literary heritage of our area, and what is going on right now in Santa Fe on the literary scene, if you will, is so much overlooked or taken for granted that I like to put a spotlight on it when I can. And so the El Rancho de las Golondrinas has sponsored an annual lecture series to focus on the tradition and the culture. And this year, they've done that for about 10 years now. And this year, most of the speakers, and there are only three of us, but we have chosen topics that tie into the theme of the 400th anniversary celebration. And so mine is turning the pages of Santa Fe stories past and present, which will be presented on Thursday night, January 28th at 7 o'clock at the Santuario de Guadalupe in downtown Santa Fe. And as I said, this is part of the lecture series. They're going to be held the last Thursday of each month, January, February, and March. Admission is free, but I'm told that the seating often gets tight because these are popular lecture series, and so people are encouraged to come early. May I mention the other two speakers in the lecture
yes,
series?
Yes, please do.
On February 25th will be Billy the Kid in Story and Song, presented by Mark Gardner, who has written a new book focusing on Pat Garrett's final manhunt for Billy the Kid. The book is called To Hell on a Fast Horse. And then on March 25th, Laura Gomez, who's a professor of law and American studies at the University of New Mexico, will present on Manifest Destinies, The Making of the Mexican-American Race. All these lectures begin at 7 o'clock at the Santuario de Guadalupe, sponsored by the Santuario and El Rancho de las Golondrinas.
Barbara, how has the Santa Fe literary scene developed since you've been here? You've been here, what, almost 20 years?
Yes. I came here in 1993. And when I moved here, the only formal literary presence that I'm aware of was Recursos de Santa Fe and their Southwest Literary Center, and they were having an annual Santa Fe Writers Conference. And also, our dear friend Dorothy Doyle's reading sampler on KSFR
right.
was in existence, had been going on for several years at that time. At that time, Santa Fe had at least two more independent bookstores that are no longer with us, the old Santa Fe Trail Bookstore and Rail Yard Books.
We're still doing pretty well,
but
though.
But we're still doing very well, and Santa Fe is per capita about the best, the best well-read community, and has more authors per capita than any other community in the United States.
That's
and
crazy.
So there's a lot going on with three branches of our public library, one of whom is named for a local author, Oliver Lafarge. And we've had the Santa Fe Short Story Festival. The library was, for a number of years, sponsoring the Festival of the Book. There are numerous lecture series going on now for part of the 400th anniversary. And then, of course, with our fine independent bookstores, Collected Works and Garcia Street Books, we also have wonderful antiquarian books. There's just a lot going on in Santa Fe on the literary scene, and I want to call it to people's attention so they can enjoy it.
Barbara Harrelson is author of the book Walks in Literary Santa Fe, A Guide to Landmarks, Legends, and Lore. If people want to get in touch with you, how do they do so?
They can send me an email at barbarah@newmexico.com.
BarbaraH@newmexico.com, that's easy.
Yes, and my phone number is 989-4561.
Barbara Harrelson, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find me at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.